From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Debates over a failing economy, possible sex scandals, controversies over press partisanship. Sounds like the American presidential primaries, but it's also the story of the British elections, which are coming up this Thursday. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with William Schmidt, the London correspondent for the New York Times. Also, we talk with singer and songwriter Peter Case about his new album and about the days when he was not only playing on the streets, he was living on them. And world music commentator Milo Miles listens to the musicians of Djoudjouka in Morocco. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Voters headed to the polls today in New York, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Kansas. New York offers the big prize with 244 Democratic delegates. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
New York is a proving ground today for the Democratic presidential candidates. For Bill Clinton, it's a referendum on whether he can continue to keep his head above water, in spite of questions about his character. For Jerry Brown, it's a chance to keep the momentum going from his small victories in Vermont and Connecticut. And former candidate Paul Tsongas is also looking closely at the results today. Tsongas has hinted broadly that he'd like to return to the race, but he wants to first see how well he does in New York before making the decision. His name is still on the ballot here, and he said today he doubts he'd have money problems because of all the people who will feel guilty they didn't give to him when he was first in the race. The results will depend largely on voter turnout, which election officials expect will be lower than 30%. In 1988, just under 50% turned out to give Jesse Jackson a primary victory in the city. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in New York.
Exit polls show that Democrats in all the primary states would rather see another candidate in the race. Cable News Network reported that 66% of the voters in New York were dissatisfied with the choices in the Democratic primary. In Wisconsin and Kansas, some 66% said they wanted another choice. That dissatisfaction was reflected in the turnout in New York, where only about 25% of the Democratic voters were expected to cast ballots. In Wisconsin, today's turnout was only three-quarters of what it was 4 years ago. Former White House Chief of Staff John Sununu has reimbursed the federal government about $4,200 for the use of government planes and cars for his personal travel. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Sununu paid the bill after the Independent Office of Government Ethics found that an earlier review of his use of government planes and cars was incomplete. That review was conducted by White House legal counsel Boyden Gray shortly after it was revealed that Sununu had traveled at government expense for personal purposes. The former New Hampshire governor then reimbursed the government $1,423 to pay for two trips he made. Now the Office of Government Ethics says Sununu owed another $4,242 for three other trips, two of which were to the ski slopes of Aspen and Vail, Colorado. Sununu has already written out the check. White House spokeswoman Judy Smith says that after the Sununu affair, the administration has revamped its rules governing personal and political travel. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Colorado's Democratic Party chairman said today that Senator Tim Wirth has decided not to run for a second term. Howard Gelt said that Wirth will announce the decision at a news conference in Denver tomorrow. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 62 points to close at 3,213.6. This is NPR News. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has taken control of the former Soviet Navy's Black Sea Fleet. Both Russia and Ukraine claim the fleet, made up of about 300 ships, some of which can carry nuclear weapons. Yeltsin issued a decree today saying that Russia will fund the fleet but keep it under the joint military command of the Commonwealth of Independent States. The decree came in response to Ukraine's announcement yesterday that it was assuming formal legal control over all nuclear and conventional forces on its territory, including the fleet. The fleet is based in the Black Sea port of Sevastopol, which is in Ukraine. The National Hockey League will know by Thursday whether or not there'll be Stanley Cup playoffs this year, as Evan Weiner reports from New York.
The National Hockey League Players Association has a take-it-or-leave-it proposal in front of them that must be answered by Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. There will be no further negotiations, although both sides could talk to one another for clarification until the deadline hits. The owners have offered the players all the monies they traditionally receive from trading cards, also a more liberalized form of free agency. In addition, there would be improvements in the medical and pension benefits in a two-year deal retroactive to September 15, 1991. For National Public Radio, I'm Evan Weiner in New York.
The United States officially recognized three former Yugoslav republics as independent states today. President Bush issued a statement recognizing the independence of Slovenia, Croatia, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. He indicated that the United States is also prepared to recognize the Republic of Macedonia as an independent nation. Greece has objected to Macedonian independence out of fear that an independent Macedonia might lay claim to the neighboring Greek province of the same name. President Bush's statement pledged to work with the European community to resolve Greek objections. The president lifted the four-month-old economic sanctions against the four republics. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The tune you're hearing is It's Time for Labor, the campaign theme music for the British Labor Party. It was composed by Michael Kamen, who also did the score for the movie Robin Hood. The Conservatives have a theme, which is a variation on Purcell's Rondo by Andrew Lloyd Webber. The Liberal Democratic Party theme was composed by the drummer of the band Bucks Fizz. America obviously has no corner on theatricality when it comes to political campaigns. Here in the States, the New York primary is the big news. In England, the big event is Thursday's general election. Conservative Prime Minister John Major is being challenged by Labour candidate Neil Kinnock and Liberal Democratic Party candidate Patty Ashdown. The Tories have ruled for 13 years. So how do the British elections compare to ours? We asked William Schmidt to join us from NPR's London Bureau. Schmidt is the London correspondent for the New York Times. The British campaign has officially lasted only 4 weeks. I asked Schmidt if he thinks the short time span of the British campaign season makes for a more sane approach than ours.
Well, in theory, the British approach is more sane. The election process, the campaign itself, only works out to be about 4 weeks from the time the prime minister actually calls the election until the time people go to the polls. But in fact, the process does stretch on a lot longer than that. There is so much uncertainty for months and months and months before the prime minister calls the election that, in fact, you already are in on a campaign footing prior to the election date being set. The British papers refer to this as the phony election, but it's as much a campaign as the primary process is in the United States. In addition, I think the way the press deals with the campaign here, in particular the tabloid press, that it does tend to magnify some of the more egregious excesses of the campaign process. I think at this moment, as we approach Election Day, looking around at the newspapers and looking around at what's going on here, I think things are probably as insane here as they seem to you in New York.
Well, you know, in the United States, there's so much big money spent on TV ads. I think that's one of the biggest expenses for the presidential campaigns. There aren't any TV ads in England. There's a law against candidates spending their money on TV ads?
Under British election law, you cannot buy advertising time on television for political purposes. The government allots each of the parties time to present their case. They give them free time. The Labour Party and the Conservative Party, for example, the two major parties, are given, I believe it is, five free broadcasts. They can go up to 10 minutes. They can keep it at 5 minutes if they would like. These are often theatrically produced episodes. The Conservatives use John Schlesinger,
he's directed Midnight Cowboy and Marathon Man.
Exactly. The Labour Party used Hugh Hudson, who did Chariots of Fire. He also put together a piece for them in the 1987 election. But that is about it as far as television. Just these party broadcasts, and other than that, The candidates, the parties, do not have access to either television or to radio for political advertising.
In the 30 and 60 second spots on American television, you're either going to see an extended campaign slogan or, as likely, a negative ad, you know, bashing your opponent. So since in England you don't have 30 and 60 second spots, you have up to 10 minutes. What are the presentations like? What kind of content do you find in those 10 minute broadcasts?
Well, they tend to revolve around a particular theme, so that the Labour Party a few weeks ago, for example, chose national health policy as a theme, and they devoted their 10 minutes to what they said were the failures of the Conservative administration to administer in a fair and efficient way the National Health Service. Now, that broadcast, in fact, became a political issue itself because the broadcast used kind of a docudrama format. They hired actors who took the roles of real-life people to describe, in this case, the situation of a young girl who had, according to the Labour Party, been denied an ear operation because of failures in the health service. As it turned out, when the girl's name was revealed, not something that the Labour Party wanted to do, questions were raised about whether, in fact, she had been the problems she had with the operation were the result of failures within the health service or were a bureaucratic error. The girl's mother came out and said that she thought that the Labour Party was misusing her daughter. So I guess all of this is just a long way of saying that even though the intent is good, to remove this bogeyman of the paid political advertising, the quick negative spot, the perils still remain even within this system.
Oh, by the way, I know Andrew Lloyd Webber of Cats and Phantom of the Opera fame has written a theme song for the Conservatives. How is that being used?
Well, each of the parties have theme songs. And one of the arguments that you hear this time around is that the elections in the American fashion have become much more theatrical. And each of the parties hired composers to write theme music. The Liberal Democrats, the third party, the party with the least amount of money, hired a fellow who was a keyboardist for a pop group called Bucks Fizz. So they went kind of low scale, and they put together a piece called Liberal Democrat Fanfare. The Labour Party hired the fellow who wrote the soundtrack for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and of course the Tories went with the trump card, and that was Andrew Lloyd Webber. He did not actually compose the piece. He took a 17th century work by Henry Purcell and added some ruffles and flourishes and drum rolls. But every time John Major appears at one of his campaign rallies. And these rallies, by the way, like the Labour rallies, which are held with a traveling set in various cities through Britain, are very theatrical themselves, highly orchestrated. As he enters the amphitheater, this very dramatic music strikes up as he comes down to address the audience, often in the round.
Let's talk about the press coverage of the elections in England. You've got the tabloids and you've got the broadsheets. What's the tabloid coverage like? And by the tabloids, you know, we're not talking about weeklies in the supermarkets. We're talking about daily newspapers.
We're talking about mass circulation daily newspapers. Tabloid simply refers to the format, along papers like the like New York Newsday that are just that size, as opposed to broadsheets, a full-size paper like the New York Times. The tabloid coverage is what it has always been here. It's dramatic. It's highly partisan. It's highly charged. The tabloids show their bias in their daily coverage, and the broadsheets are more circumspect. But I think it's important to note that there are different traditions and in fact, different expectations about British journalism as opposed to what we're used to in the States. So the idea that that you find opinions in your newspapers are not, I don't think people here react as sharply or as negatively to that idea as we do in the States.
Can you remember any particularly snappy headlines from the tabloids recently?
My favorite, I think, was the day that John Smith, who is the chief economic spokesman for the Labour Party, announced his strategy for Britain should the Labour Party win the election. And the next day, the Daily Mirror, which is a pro-Labour tabloid, ran a front page which consisted of photographs of homeless people, of closed hospital wards, of people in unemployment lines. And the headline above all of these photographs was, "Goodbye to all this," suggesting that should Mr. Smith and Labour get into office, as they hope, that magically all of these economic problems would disappear. In that same paper, on page 3, there was a photograph of John Major in a fish market, and it showed Mr. Major looking over a counter while a clerk displayed fish to him. It was some campaign stop. And the only caption on the photograph was, "Spot the fish face." So as you can see, these papers don't, they pull no punches. They take no prisoners when it comes to a political point of view. And this is not the first time. In the 1987 election, the same thing happened. The Sun, which is another mass circulation tabloid, which has a circulation of about 3.6 million, which is about the same as the Daily Mirror. The Sun is a Tory paper, and in 1987, among the articles that it ran during the election was an article with the headline, "Why I'm Voting for Kinnock" by Joseph Stalin. I never did see the copy, but the headline, I think, got a point the point across to the readers.
In the United States, as we know, the personal lives of candidates have been investigated, and you had the Jennifer Flowers story causing big problems for Bill Clinton for a while. Any equivalents in England? Are the personal lives of the candidates under the same kind of scrutiny, and are people looking for scandal in the way they seem to be searching for it in the States?
No, they tend to stay away from that here. There was an episode before the campaign began in which Patty Ashdown, who is the head of the Liberal Democrats, confessed that he had had an adulterous affair several years ago. The confession was not altogether voluntary. Somebody had broken into the offices of his lawyers some many months ago, and among the documents that were stolen was an internal memorandum in which Mr. Ashdown had discussed this affair with his attorney. When the Liberal Democrats discovered that this document had fallen into the hands of the newspapers, they sought to enforce an injunction through the courts that would prevent the British newspapers from printing the story. But the rumors were flying. Everybody on Fleet Street and in Parliament knew that this story was out there. It was about to break. But there was an injunction forbidding its publication. They managed neatly to get around that by the story going to a paper in Scotland which was not covered by the injunction. Once the story ran, Mr. Ashdown then appeared at press conferences, admitted to the affair, and there was some discussion over the next several days about what this would mean. There were efforts to find the woman in question. She made herself available. There were a set of interviews. And several days later, the next time a poll was taken, Mr. Ashdown's popularity had shot up. When Mr. Ashdown was asked to explain this, he said that this was a reflection of the good faith and the understanding of the British people. I think the feeling that others had at the time was that when you're the third political party, any publicity is good publicity, and his name recognition certainly improved from that point on. That was probably the closest we've gotten to the American experience here, and it really didn't go any farther than that.
My guest is William Schmidt. He's joining us from London, where he's a correspondent for the New York Times. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the British elections. My guest is William Schmidt. He's the London correspondent for the New York Times. So what are the big issues in the campaign this year?
The dominant issue is the economy and what the Conservative government, after 12 or 13 years in power, has done to worsen or to improve the economic well-being of Britons. Unemployment is very high, as it is in the United States. Inflation has been down, but there have been record numbers of business failures, bankruptcies, housing foreclosures, and the central issue in the campaign seems to be the state of the British economy, and this, for the Tories, for the Conservatives, has been the most difficult issue to deal with.
In the United States, you have this anger, I think, that's been expressed at George Bush and his administration for concentrating so much on foreign affairs in the past few years at the expense, perhaps, of the American economy. I mean, that's what a lot of Americans have been expressing. Is there a similar kind of anger that's been expressed toward Margaret Thatcher and John Major?
Yes, there is. There are people who are very unhappy and angry about what's happened. There is a feeling among some people, I guess you could call them the British equivalent to the to Reagan Democrats. These are people who during the Thatcher era came over to her side. She attracted many people, middle-class people, because there was a period in the 1980s when economic growth was strong, when people were encouraged to own their own homes, when breaks were given to people who live, for example, in public housing in order to buy their public housing so they could own their own homes. And many of these people now feel betrayed because they bought in. They bought property. They took on debt. Interest rates soared. They now find themselves stretched, and they feel that the government has not done anything to help them out of the situation. Whether that perception is accurate or not, whether in fact the Tories would have been able to do very much to deal with the kinds of economic tangle that they've now found themselves in, just as many of the industrialized nations have found themselves in an economic morass at this point, that's a more problematical question.
Last year at this time, George Bush seemed unbeatable because of the Gulf War victory, and that didn't seem to last for him very long in terms of his popularity in the polls. And I wonder if the Gulf War is figuring into the equation in the elections in Britain, and if so, how?
Well, there are really remarkable parallels between the situation in the States and the situation in Britain. John Major, like George Bush, was extremely popular here last year by all poll measures at the time of the Gulf War and in the period after the Gulf War. And those who like to armchair quarterback now say that the biggest mistake that John Major and the Tories made was not calling the election last year when they were riding this crest of popularity. They chose not to. The economic numbers at that time were still very, very bad, and I think there was their hope, much as the Republicans are hoping that that before November things will improve in the States. The Conservatives were banking on an improvement in the British economy. The problem they had here is that the clock stopped running on them. You have to call the new election within 5 years of the last election. And the final moment, the last date that Major was looking at would have been May or June, and he had already committed himself by his own rhetoric to going for the April election, and there just wasn't time. The irony here is that if there is a recovery underway in Britain, slowly, grudgingly, as there seems to be in the States, and if Labour should win this week, they may likely get credit for what the Tories or simply international economic forces set in motion months ago.
Did you ever cover the elections in the U.S.?
Yes.
What are you doing differently as a reporter now in England than you did when you were covering campaigns in America?
It really isn't that much different in terms of the nuts and bolts of the coverage. You get on a bus, you travel around with a candidate, you listen to what he says or she says, and you are counseled by the spin doctors, which is one of these terms that's relatively new to the British experience, but they're all over the place now. You see them on television, you see them on the campaign. So the actual reporting of the campaign is the same. One difference, I think, is that you don't have quite as much access to the campaign as you do in the States. Space is much more tightly meted out. Often you can't get on the buses with the candidates.
So before we go, which aspect of the American campaign has made the biggest splash in the British press?
Well, the trials and tribulations of Bill Clinton continue to fascinate British readers, and the British reporters in the States have spent a lot of energy, it seems, and time dealing with these with this question. There is a fascination with Jerry Brown and who he is. We haven't seen much on George Bush recently, but then again. Like the Republicans, the Brits are now watching the Democrats devour one another.
Would you like to wager who's going to win in the British elections?
I'll fall back on the conventional wisdom here now, which is that the race is so close, and this is what all the polls suggest at this point, that we may end up with what is called here a hung parliament. That is, that neither the Conservatives nor Labour will achieve a majority in the balloting on Thursday. That is, there's 651 seats. So, in order for a party to form a government, they will have to win 326 seats. And the polls now suggest that that both Labour and the Conservatives will fall short of that. The feeling is that Labour may well emerge as the larger party. And if it is to govern, it's going to have to form some sort of pact or a coalition with a third party. In this case, the party that's really holding, the people who are really holding the Trump card now, if this is the scenario, would be the Liberal Democrats, the third party. But they want to exact a price for this. And the price that they want to exact is what they call proportional representation. Under the British system now, whoever wins the first past the post system, they call it, whoever wins a parliamentary seat, the party that achieves the most vote, wins the seat in Parliament. Now, the Liberal Democrats came in second in more than 200 seats in 1987. They received some 20% of the vote, yet they only have 3% of the seats because they only won outright 3% of the constituencies. What the Liberal Democrats want from this election is a parliament that will be apportioned to some degree on the basis of the split in the popular vote as a whole.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
William Schmidt is a London correspondent for The New York Times. He spoke with us from NPR's London Bureau. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet the man with the blue postmodern fragmented neo-traditionalist guitar. We talk with Peter Case about his songs and his life. One of the Rolling Stones recorded with them. Ornette Coleman made an album with them. But aside from that, the master musicians of Jujuka have rarely been recorded. Coming up, world music commentator Myla Miles reviews a new recording of these Moroccan musicians. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Voters in several states are taking part today in presidential primaries, and according to exit poll data aired on ABC and CNN, there has been low voter turnout in both New York and Wisconsin. Voting officials in Kansas say that there's been a low voter turnout in that state as well. Vance Heiner of member station KANU reports.
So far, election officials say voting is down 25% from 1980 when Kansas held its first presidential primary. Light rain has been reported around the state, and Kansas Secretary of State Bill Graves says the turnout is even lower than he expected. The only controversy so far has been over how Jerry Brown's name appears on the ballot. The former Democratic governor of California is listed as Edmund G. Brown, Jr. from Alexandria, Virginia. That's caused some confusion, and a number of Brown supporters are saying they can't find their candidate's name on the ballot. For National Public Radio, I'm Vance Heiner in Lawrence, Kansas.
Both ABC and CNN are reporting that their exit poll information indicates that 66% of the voters in New York wish that there was some other candidate for which to vote. ABC reports that 51% of those voting for Paul Tsongas did it for negative reasons, because they didn't like the other candidates. In New York, some 50% of the Democratic voters said that they believed Bill Clinton had integrity. 46% disagreed. As for a flat tax proposed by Jerry Brown, only 20% thought that it would be more fair than the current system, and 48% said it would be less fair. Officials in Ireland have announced that a referendum on abortion will be held. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports.
Prime Minister Albert Reynolds feared a repeat of the divisive 1983 battle that resulted in a constitutional amendment that banned abortion in Ireland except when the mother's life is in danger. That law had been widely interpreted as preventing any abortions in Ireland. It was tested in February when a court ruled that a 14-year-old alleged rape victim could not leave the country for an abortion. The case was appealed to the Irish Supreme Court, which allowed the girl to have the operation. Since then, anti-abortion groups in Ireland have demanded a new referendum. The abortion issue has also threatened ratification of the Maastricht Treaty, the European Community's new agreement on economic and political union. The treaty contains a protocol assuring Ireland that EC law does not interfere with the Irish constitutional ban on abortion. The Maastricht Treaty must be approved by referendum in Ireland, and Irish politicians feared the debate over Maastricht would turn into a debate on abortion. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials dropped 62 points to close at 3,213.55 on volume of some 205 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 3-1. This is NPR News. According to congressional investigators, Patriot missiles were not nearly as effective against Iraqi Scuds during the Persian Gulf War as the Army has said. While disagreeing with this conclusion, the Army told the House Government Operations Committee it has now revised its evaluation, finding that the Patriot was successful 60% of the time instead of 70%. Congressional investigators say the Army's claims cannot be supported. Russia and Ukraine are continuing to struggle over who will control the arms of the old Soviet Union, with Russia today claiming control over the entire Black Sea Naval Fleet. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
It was Marshal Yevgeny Shaprishnikov, commander of all the military forces of the Commonwealth of Independent States, who made the decision known today during a session of the Russian Congress of People's Deputies. Shaprishnikov said a decree is on President Boris Yeltsin's desk awaiting his signature. It places the Black Sea Fleet, some 300 warships, an equal number of warplanes, and thousands of soldiers and sailors, under exclusively Russian jurisdiction. Until now, the fleet has remained the joint property of the Commonwealth, but Ukraine has claimed control of it. And yesterday, Ukraine's president, Leonid Kravchuk, signed his own decree placing the fleet under his jurisdiction. Today, according to Russian reports, Ukraine ordered the aircraft of the fleet on its territory grounded. Both moves, Moscow's and Kiev's, are certain to aggravate tensions between the two former republics of the Soviet Union. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Secretary of State James Baker has called on Ukraine to go along with Russia and cut back on nuclear stockpiles. Baker indicated today if this is not done, then there could be a drop in U.S. aid. Ukraine has sent more than half of its nuclear weapons to Russia, where they are said to be destroyed, but has declined to send the rest. Government leaders in Ukraine say that they are not sure the weapons are being destroyed. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There was a time when Peter Case not only played on the streets, he lived on them. But that's behind him. He just released his third solo album on a major label. His previous album, The Man with the Blue Postmodern Fragmented Neo-Traditionalist Guitar, was named as one of the best releases of 1989 in the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times. Case is often praised for the imagery in his lyrics, but they're not the product of his formal education. He dropped out of high school after the ninth grade. Case grew up near Buffalo and hit the road as a teenager. In San Francisco, he played with the band The Nerves, which opened for such bands as Devo and the Ramones. In L.A., he formed the Plimsolls, a local band that developed a national cult following. Let's hear how Case sounds today on his new album, Six Pack of Love. This is Vanishing Act, written by Peter Case and Tony O'Kay.
What happened to that baby? What happened to my girl? She used to be my true love. Now she's vanished from this world. The last time that I saw her, she said that she was fine. Now they're tearing down her building and they're taking out her line. Oh, but that's all right.
I started writing songs when I was about, I guess I was in sixth grade, and I just always made up songs and sang them and had a band and played coffee houses, and it was, you know, back then music was so exciting that, like, when I'd get near a place where people were playing music, I would run from a few blocks away. I'd get close to it. It was just so exciting, man. I just couldn't stand it. So I had to I would run into places with my guitar when I had to play somewhere or something.
I believe your parents were teachers. They probably weren't very happy when you dropped out of school.
How do you know my parents were teachers? Yeah, they were, and they weren't. And that's the way it goes, though.
Did they try to do anything to get you to go back?
Yeah, there was just no way to get me to go back. You want to know about the day I quit going to school?
Sure.
You know, because it was because of poetry and T.S. Eliot. And the teacher was teaching this poem called The Hollow Men. And there, she was reading The Hollow Men to this class, and I was like sort of in this state of heightened awareness sitting in this class. At least that's what it seemed like to me. And it seemed like time stopped, and she was reading this poem, The Hollow Men, and I was looking around at all these kids next to me, and I felt so out of touch with everybody. And I began to think that, God, T.S. Eliot's right, you know? This really is an empty life, and the whole thing they're making us, they're teaching us for is just for money and for material things. And I was overcome by this really intense fear, and I jumped up and I ran out of the class in the middle of The Hollow Men by T.S. Eliot. I swear. And I never went back to school again. I said, I'm never going to go back there. And I'm still to this day, you know, I've had a bad run-in with education. What can I say? You know, I think it's really good for people to get educated. But for me, it was so painful being in school that I still am glad. You know, it's been 20 years. You know, I can still be thankful that I'm not in school today. If nothing else, at least I'm not staring out of a schoolroom window. But maybe just the school I was in was especially boring, but...
So what did you do with your time when you left school?
What did I do with my time? I didn't have a very good sense of time, but I did play with bands all the time. And, I had a band called Pig Nation that played around. This was back in Buffalo. I'd actually dropped out of school, but I got a GED, and then I went over to University of Buffalo and talked my way in there, and I actually did one semester there. But I remember I took all my books when I cashed them in, and then I went down and bought a bus ticket at the Greyhound station down on Main Street for Chicago. I remember going underneath the elevated trains there into a bar and getting drunk on whiskey, and then I bought a train ticket for San Francisco. and I ended up out in San Francisco, and I started playing on the street out there when I got out there. I was a street musician.
Well, you were living on the street too, right?
Yeah, that's true too. I didn't really have an apartment for about 2 years when I got out there. So this is the 70s, and... to tell you the truth, you know, I was kind of one of those guys that you see, like, walking around with a guitar on in the rain. You know those kind of guys?
It's kind of not very good for you or the guitar, is it?
No. And, you know, I slept in a few movie theaters, and it was sort of a long period of my life. It was a difficult time, but through it all, I kept playing guitar. In fact, guitar's always sort of been my security blanket, you know?
Was sleeping on the streets and sleeping in movie theaters part of, like, your lifestyle choice, or were you feeling very forced into doing that because you were broke?
I was forced into it because I was broke, but to tell you the truth, I was really, I was one of those guys you see walking around the rain, you know what I mean?
Oblivious?
So I didn't really know, you know, I mean, every night it would get dark, and oh, boy, it's getting dark again today. One of those kind of guys. It's going to probably get cold, too, just like yesterday. And still don't have any place to... You know, I was like the grasshopper you see in that old cartoon, the grasshopper and the ant. I'd just play music all day, and then at night it would get dark, and, you know. But it was a real difficult period of my life, to tell you the truth, and I really feel for people who go through anything like that. I was pretty disoriented. And I also learned about music, though, at that whole time, and I was studying music from people that played at, like, the Coffee Gallery up there at the folk clubs, and Mike Wilhelm from the Charlatans was playing on the street, and I had a set, and every song on my set was about death, and it was all blues songs, and Mike liked those songs, and he wanted to hire me on as a singer, except I wasn't old enough to sing in any of the bars he was playing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is singer, songwriter, guitarist Peter Case. His new album is called Six Pack of Love. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Peter Case is my guest. Let's hear something from your new album, Six Pack of Love. This is, I think, a really catchy, rootsy song called Why Don't We Give It a Go? It was co-written by you and Billy Swan, and he's best known for Lover Please. That's Lover Please, Please Come Back.
Yeah.
Don't Take the Train Going Down the Track.
Yeah, that's Billy. Billy wrote that. He's one of the great rock and roll songwriters, I think.
So how'd you get together with him? Did you seek him out?
Yeah, you know, I'd met him over the years. When I was doing the Blue Guitar record, they were in the next room with Jerry Lee Lewis. T-Bone and Billy were in there making the soundtrack to Great Balls of Fire.
Right.
I think I met Billy down there at that time. And then we'd, I think I was playing with Bob Neuwirth and Steve Young. We were doing like a songwriter's night over in Venice, and Billy came down and sang a song with us. And shortly after that, we started writing together. He was real interesting for me to write with, and it was a lot of fun. We wrote a bunch of songs. There's two of them on the record. Why Don't We Give It a Go? It's a twisted version of rockabilly. Billy just made a record Sun Records is releasing records again, and Billy just cut the song and put it out on his Sun album. But our version's a little different. I think it's a little more twisted or something, you know, sort of twisted roots or something.
Well, why don't we hear Why Don't We Give It a Go from Peter Case's new album, Six Pack of Love.
They say love is like a rocket ship, a roller coaster, double back over flip, a blaze of fire reaching out of control. Why don't we give it a go?
They say love is like a hurricane. It's like a thunder and a pouring rain. A wind is shaking from your head to your toes. Why don't we give it a go? Why don't we? Why don't we? Why don't we? Jump right into the middle of it, you and I. Let's give it a try. They say love is like a...
Peter Case from his album Six Pack of Love. Can I ask you how you became a Christian and what happened in your life that inspired that change?
Well, it's you know, that's something that had been coming for a really long time. I was brought up without any religion. My parents had left the church that they were in when they were young, and they didn't believe. My father's sort of a scientist. Scientific type mentality, and I just always felt that there was something more to life than just, you know, you lived and you died and you were buried and you were gone. You know, I believe in. I became aware over the years of what felt to me was the soul, like the soul, you know, of a person, or the living essence of people was different from. Separate from their bodies. It's just something I've always felt, and it was a growing awareness. And also, over the years, I felt that the way I was living was in direct contradiction to. I began to see that it was just that I wasn't made for living like the way I was, you know. And
like which part of it?
Well, just the whole part of it, and. Thinking that, you know, just this world is it, and the success in this world means something, and, you know, I didn't feel like it was possible that we were just here for no purpose, and you know, I really became, you know, it is pretty personal, because, you know, I really became convicted of my own sin. I mean, people don't want to hear about sin that much when they're driving around listening to the radio on this channel, but that's just the way I felt, you know. I mean, it was a real personal, painful experience for me, and you know, I had a mystical experience. I mean, I asked. I mean, if you ask Jesus into your life, something, your life will change. I guarantee you, and somebody will come into your life. And I don't believe in religion, and I don't believe in organized churches necessarily. And I don't believe that, you know, that it's all. I don't believe it's about guilt. I believe that Christ was about love and forgiveness.
So you had a born again experience.
You could call it that. That's an ad campaign term, you know. I don't necessarily believe in, you know. Yeah, I mean, you could say I had a born again experience, but that's like, you know, it's like somebody said once, you know, I think Dylan or somebody said every word has its big word and its small word, you know, small letters and big letters, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And like, you can just say born again experience, like you say, you know, the real thing is Coca-Cola.
Right.
You know, it's not. You know, it trivializes it. You know.
Yeah.
And. You know, and if I use it on somebody else, it trivializes them, you know, so I don't use that term, you know. So, you know, I really feel, you know, there's really big magical things that are going on here in life that you know, that you don't read about in USA Today, really, you know.
You once said that you write songs about sin and salvation. Do you think that your spiritual experience changed your songwriting in any way?
Yeah, absolutely, you know. How could it not, you know? It it changed the whole way I look at the world, you know, and the whole way I see everything, and everything started to become clear to me, you know. I started to understand things I could never understand before, you know.
But what I mean is you're not writing the kind of pop known as Christian music.
Oh, I never would or do, you know, no. I mean, I don't think there's such, you know, I don't think there is Christian music, you know. I'm a Christian, you know, if I play music, you know what I mean? That may be Christian music, but it's not what's called Christian music out in the world today, where there's a whole separate record stores and they have separate magazines and they
separate radio stations.
That, you know?
Yeah.
They said, you know, it says in the Bible you don't want to hide your faith underneath a basket, you know? You know, you want to hide your light. You know, you don't want to hide your light. You want to shine it from the top of the, you know, from the top of the hill, right? And I don't just play for Christians. I care, you know. Of course, I'm not necessarily evangelizing in my music either, you know.
I want to play a song of yours that I think is a really powerful song. It's from your previous album, and the song's called Put Down the Gun. Can you talk about writing this? What was on your mind when you wrote it?
The power of surrender, and You know, sometimes the fight just has to be given up, you know, the fight to keep it all together and keep control. And then finally, I mean, the final level of it is guns, you know, where people, you know, are trying to control other people with force and control their own mind, you know, police their own brain.
What gave you the image of the gun for the song?
Well, everybody runs around, you know, America carries a lot of guns, and you see guns all over the streets. You know, I've been in clubs where they told me to lay down on stage if there's any shooting. And I've had guns pulled on me a number of times, as probably most Americans have. And I guess it just seemed, you know, it's put down the gun and we'll talk. You know, stop killing you and yourself. You know, it could be a gun or a needle or a pipe or a baseball bat or just an attitude.
Let's hear Put Down the Gun, and this is from Peter Case's album, The Man with the Blue Postmodern Fragmented Neo-Traditionalist Guitar. A great title, I have to say.
On the hills outside of town, there's a hiding place where the green fields sway with lavender, mustard, and Queen Anne's lace. Where the silent clouds go sailing in a sea of Dutchman's blue, and the lonesome tracks by the railroad cut make me think of you. And a train we missed, I loved you from the first time I looked upon your face. Though I didn't know your story, I could feel your wild grace. Now you got yourself in trouble, that ain't nothing new. Then there's always been someone watching over you. So put down the gun, put down the gun, put down your gun. Put down the gun, put down the gun, put down your gun. Well, you grew up on a street where the cops don't go alone, in a town just like a wishing well.
That's Peter Case from his previous album, The Man with the Blue Postmodern Etc. Guitar. His new album is Six Pack of Love. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll be asking questions about the showdown strike, the United Auto Workers versus Caterpillar. The company is now advertising for replacement workers, says it needs a less costly contract than the UAW has with the Deere Company, for example, to be able to compete in the worldwide market. The United States is recognizing Bosnia-Herzegovina and Croatia, as well as Slovenia. Hardly a Yugoslavia left. We'll analyze the U.S. move. Also, Jane Howard reports from Sarajevo on the violence there, the clash between Croats and Muslims and Serbs. Also, Margot Adler reports from New York on women writers who are underappreciated in their view.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. By Western standards, the master musicians of Djoujouka from Morocco boast impeccable hip credentials. First, William Burroughs told Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones about them. Then Ornette Coleman went and recorded with them. Now postmodernist producer Bill Laswell has recorded a new album of their music called Apocalypse Across the Sky. World music commentator Milo Miles says it's a long overdue, definitive recording of Djoujouka's wild, timeless wail.
For musicians with such mystique, the masters of Djoujouka have been recorded very sporadically. Some snippets turn up on North African folklore collections. Brian Jones made a low-tech but adequate recording when he visited in the late 60s, then messed up the results with phase shifters and quarts of echo effect. To my knowledge, the only readily available album from Djoujouka before Apocalypse Across the Sky was a very exciting, rather brief collection called simply The Master Musicians of Djoujouka, on Adelphi Records. The performances were recorded 20 years ago, and the record's been out of print for a long time. So what immediately hits you about Laswell's new recording is the crystalline modern fidelity. The Jajoukins live a hardscrabble existence in the not very fertile low mountains of northern Morocco. The job of master musician is inherited, and if you don't ever tend the fields or repair the houses, you better put on a pretty intense show to make up for it. And that they do. The instruments featured in Jajouka ensembles include lutes, fiddles, flutes, and large and small drums. But what snaps everyone alert is the furious piping of the double reed horn the French call a musette. These horns are quite widespread around Asia and the Mediterranean, but no one plays them with the determination and finesse of the Jajoukins. Some larger performances involve women's groups who sing their own specific numbers, like this one called Take Care of Her or Leave Her. The master musicians are so concentrated that they take some getting used to. My one big gripe about Apocalypse Across the Sky is that while William Burroughs's liner notes fill you in about his experience of the master musicians, he doesn't explain the roots of their most dramatic ceremonies with the wilderness god Bougelou, known as the Master of Skins. Bougelou is none other than a local variant of the half-man, half-goat deity Pan, the old friend of the Greek god Dionysius. The churning musette choruses that accompany the Bougelou dances are perfect for this fertility rite. At their peak, there's even a kind of frenzy in them that suggests the ancient midnight ceremonies of Dionysius, in which a goat or a man was ripped to pieces. The sounds of Jajouka do not leave the mind easily.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. The new recording of the master musicians of Jajouka, Apocalypse Across the Sky, is distributed by Island Records. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a private eye in the Louisiana Bayou. We talk with James Lee Burke about his series of crime novels set in and around New Orleans. His latest is about an ex-Klansman turned politician. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.